Hi folks, just a content warning before we start. Later on in this episode, we explore themes of fascism, violence and oppression, which are explored through the medium of fiction, particularly comic books.
Welcome to season 4 of the Coffee and Geography podcast. The aim of the show is to get to know, explore and celebrate the diverse and intersectional range of people and their love for the world. Join your host, Kit Marie Rackley, and have fun exploring all the myriad of ways guests can connect their lives to geography. Today, let's listen to Climate Advocacy and Positive Action in the Workplace. World Issues Through the Lens of Comic Books. Learning the Heart. Stereo Photography. Amongst other things. Got your brew ready? Great. Enjoy the listen.
Hello everybody, welcome back to Coffee and Geography, and this person I spoke to the first time, I heard his very dulcet tones, haven't actually seen him on the screen until today, despite us doing a podcast in the past with previous podcast guest Andy Plastes. I can see Dave Wynn in 2D, but I can see Dave. How you doing, Dave?
Yeah, great. Thanks very much, Kit. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. It's great to see you as well. I think the last time when we did the podcast, it was pure audio only, wasn't it?
So it was.
Nice to put a face to a voice.
Yeah, I think Andy was worried about his bandwidth or something like that. But for what we're referring to, folks, is that, and it's definitely relevant, actually, for most of the listeners here, is we did a podcast about climate change in science fiction. And what we won't do, Dave, as you appreciate, because we talked about it for almost like 2 hours, didn't we, with Andy?
Yeah.
So what I'll do, I'll put a link in the description, folks, for the Great Derelict podcast episode where Dave and I and Andy talked about that. And if you want to geek out, but also go very, very full on sci-fi climate change, that is for you for the next 2 hours. But don't go yet. Listen to us first. So, Dave is, I love your intro, Dave. This is one for people who have a certain age, isn't it? ASL, old, neutered, lost. an old joke, but getting more accurate by the year. Otherwise, climate advocate, stereo photographer and harpist. And he hopes he is a small part of the solution to the climate emergency. What a great intro.
Oh, thank you.
We've completely divided the audience. Yeah, well, we've completely divided the audience now about what is this ASL business? You're going to have to explain that for I don't think I'm hip enough to have young listeners, but hey ho, we might as well explain it.
Age, sex, location was an old way of ASL the very first kind of question you might ask someone on the old chat rooms back in the day, in the early days of the internet, just to kind of get a feel for who they are and so on. Whether anyone told the truth at the time, who knows?
I never told the truth. No, I never told the truth. No, so yeah, I mean, that's it. It's the first thing. So yeah, let's see. What did we have? We had AOL Instant Messenger. There was MSN Messenger.
Yeah.
ICQ. What else? MRIC.
That's not one I use, I don't think.
But I think that was it was proto kind of chat room, kind of messenger kind of thing.
Yeah. And then for a little while we had CyberCosmos, which was the first kind of foray into kind of like graphical chat rooms and stuff. And then not long after that we had World of Warcraft, which is probably where I learned how to speed type while we're doing dungeon raids and so on, you know.
Actually, that's a good point. That's a skill, isn't it? I mean, to be able to kind of communicate on... I mean, these people who are lazy now and use headsets and microphones to communicate as they're gaming. It's like, come on, folks, get with the text. Be dexterous, you know.
Although, unfortunately, I've set my muscle memory to forever spell the wrong every time. T-E-H, and that's thanks to World of Warcraft.
Right, so we usually ask everybody what they're usually drinking now. Just a disclaimer, folks, we are recording this at 8:45 at night at the moment, so when Dave tells us about his brew, just bear the mind in time. So usually I ask what people are drinking. People say, you know, caffeine free tea at this night, or coffee, or some people say a glass of wine. And Dave, you have...
I have a lovely can of Peroni Nastro Azzurro Italiana. In fact, I've got a couple more lined up next to me, just as a little bit of hair of the dog, just to kind of help me recover after a very heavy weekend. I caught the mighty Henge. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Henge. It's a fantastic kind of like psychedelic pop rock prog type band who, and their shtick is they're a bunch of aliens come down to Earth to spread the cosmic dross, and the music is amazing. So check them out. Go on YouTube and check them out. You'll laugh, but that's the point. They're a really happy kind of like kind of full-on trance rock type band. So yeah, I had a very heavy weekend enjoying that.
Hence the hair of the dog. So. Yeah, in all fairness, this, you know, you haven't, it wasn't quite you, you know, but you're almost my 100th guest, right? And by now, if people hadn't, people are probably very, very surprised that there isn't been like more alcohol on this podcast. It's like, you know, up to now, you know, as I've mentioned to you before, there, you know, maybe a glass of wine or two, that's been there. But mostly people have been, yeah, you know, this coffee, this tea, or a bottle of water. So, you know, thank you for diversifying out the answer to that first question. I appreciate that very much.
It comes from a different geographic location than where we're sat as well. So there's a link there.
There you go, folks. So we got a bit of globalization in action then. So it's also, you know, the alcohol industry, very globalized, as we well know, and shifting because of climate change, which we will talk no doubt in the future. So Dave, you're in Cardiff right now, I believe.
Yeah.
It's pretty well known, definitely in the United Kingdom, but you know, quite internationally, really, is this place of culture and things like that. What does Cardiff mean to you? I mean, is it a place were you born and bred in the area? Is it somewhere you've been to recently? But what's Cardiff mean to Dave? How does it form you as your identity?
Yeah, I've lived here more than I've lived anywhere else for longer. So I was born to Scottish parents in England, and then we moved to Pontypridd because my father became a lecturer at the University of Morgan there, although it was called the Polytechnic of Wales at the time. And then at 5 years old, I moved up with my mum and my sister to Edinburgh and spent my formative years there until I was about 12 or 13. And then we moved back down with my father to Pontypridd when I was about 13 years old. And then I started university in Cardiff at 19, and I've been here ever since. So what's that? That's about 30 years I've been in Cardiff now. So although I still consider Edinburgh my home city, Cardiff is where I've landed, and I really, really love the city. You're quite right in saying it's a city of culture. There's so much going on here. We've got an entire street dedicated to music, Womanby Street, with Clwyd Vybach and Fuel and the Moon. So anyone visiting Cardiff who's interested in drink and music should go to Womanby Street, and it's literally the entrance of which is right by Cardiff Castle. You walk out of Womanby Street and the castle's right there. And of course we have the stadium, we have the rugby. I'm not a particularly sporty person myself, but my wife loves the rugby, so you know, I get dragged into that. So there's that too. And of course, there's the history. Cardiff Castle is actually built on top of the remains of a Roman fortification. And you can still see, when you look at the outside of Cardiff Castle and look at the new wall, the remains of the Roman wall, you can actually trace where the stones are in the Roman wall that was built upon. And we've got the keep in the centre of Cardiff, which is, you know, several hundred years old and so on. So lots of interesting history there too.
Yeah, here in Norwich, you've got remnants of the city wall as well, so you can actually trace it around to the river and Coslany and things like that. That's really awesome. And I'm thinking of now because I've got a close friend who lives in Pennycook, just outside of Edinburgh, and so been up there a few times. So I'm thinking of, out of the three castles of the capital cities on Great Britain, yeah, London. It's just all show, really, to be honest. No, Edinburgh is on the top of a freaking extinct volcano. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Do you know what? Right, I was actually going to use that as my thing at the end to try and confuse the next listener from a geographical point of view.
You still can.
All right, okay, I'll keep it quiet then. Right.
You still can, yeah. We'll slip that one in there. Yeah, so, and then you just describe, you know, Cardiff, like very, just beautifully there as well. It's like, it's, you know, us English, we're not all that, to be honest. No, and because when I heard your voice, which is really interesting, because I only heard your voice when I spoke to you before, I was like, yeah, I was like, definitely, yeah, Scottish. I can hear the Scottish, but I couldn't quite pin down. There was something else about your accent as well. I was like, because one of my best friend from Penicuik, you know, he's always been that area, the borders, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And his accent's slightly stronger than yours. Yeah. I was like, so has a little bit of like kind of Welsh, you know, lingo kind of creeped in. That must be a really interesting mix of Scottish and Welsh. It's beautiful. That's why I said dulcet tones, because it sounds musical to me.
Well, sometimes the Ponty comes out, and so does the Cardiff, you know. And hopefully it's mostly kind of like BBC Scottish, you know. Imagine a BBC
right. Scotland.
That's kind of like, and I think the only reason I've managed to maintain the Scottish accent is because of the sheer volume of Billy Connolly albums that I own in this. You know, so yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Billy Connolly, really, because we watched the kids wanted to watch The Hobbit for family movie night the last like kind of three nights, and then when he turns up as Turing, I was like, holy crap! Did you partly digitally stitch his face on as well or something? Because there's no way that he's that mobile, you know.
Well, indeed, yeah, yeah. I was a little disappointed by the Hobbit films, and that was one of the things that was a little bit kind of it brought me out of the film, because Billy Connolly just suddenly turns up in the middle of everything. And I'm like, what? Where did he come from? That wasn't in the book, you know. And it's Billy Connolly. It's not just like you know, a chieftain dwarf. It's actually Billy Connolly.
I wasn't expecting it either, to be honest. I'm definitely going to put in the show notes Billy Connolly as well. He is worth looking up, folks, to be honest. I used to my parents, when me and my sister were kids, my parents, well, particularly my dad, didn't actually mind us being, let's just put it this way, didn't mind us absorbing the cultures of adult humor, right, if you like. I think they saw it as an education. So even when I was like, you know, primary school, you know, 9, 10, going into secondary school, 11, I was watching Spitting Image and stuff like that, and like Billy Connolly sketch shows, Jasper Carrot, all that kind of stuff, you know. And so I know that was my education growing up. So
if you put a link to Billy Connolly in the show notes, I'll send you a link to my favorite sketch.
Which
is just him talking about a party in a Glasgow tenement building and how it just descends into absolute chaos. And it's just one of them. He's a great storyteller. That's his thing. Yeah. And there's not really any kind of like, well, there's a slight punchline in it kind of thing, but it's just all the characters that you meet and the circumstances that happen in this really cramped kind of like tenement building with, I won't spoil it for you. I'll send you the link for it. You can check out yourself.
That's also why, because he diversified from being a comedian to also being a host, wasn't he, of various TV shows and he did, not necessarily an environmental one, but it was like something about development or something like that, which was really profound. It was about 10 years ago, or maybe 15 years ago.
He has done a number of them. He went around, I think, Australia and America on a trike and things like that. So
yeah.
And even before he was a comedian, he was a musician, and he played with some famous musicians at the time. He was a great banjo player. Jerry Rafferty was the guy he was in a band with before Jerry Rafferty went off and became famous in his own right. You know, but that's probably a musician from my father's generation. I don't know much about Jerry Rafferty other than Billy Connolly. You know, they were a duo at one point. So yeah, there we are. Interesting factoid.
Well, there you go, folks. Hey, folks. I never thought we were going down the Henge and then the Billy Connolly route with this after talking about Cardiff. But there you go, folks. It's that's where we landed that, and this is the beauty of such podcasts. So what will be very interesting to a lot of people, I think, Dave, is the vast majority of the people listening to this is because of the geography side of things. Mm-hmm. And of course, by this, we mean geography in the loose terms, the UK kind of centric term of geography, to incorporate the processes, human natural processes on the entire planet, not the US version of geography, you know, just, you know, getting things wrong on a map. So, and one of the things that we know that is exceptionally powerful encompassing, almost consuming now in the geography sphere is, of course, the climate change, the issue of climate change. Yeah. And that's how we came to meet each other, was through Andy's podcast talking about climate change in fiction and whatnot. And so you call yourself a climate advocate, which is really interesting. So how did that come about? I mean, how did you end up thinking to yourself, I mean, were you always environmentally minded? Was this always an issue that you felt very passionate about? Or was there any particular spark or any particular kind of realization that you had that thought, hang on a minute, I need to be someone who's active on this kind of issue?
I would say that I've been environmentally aware since I was about maybe 13 years old, and learned about some of the problems that we were already facing way back in the kind of 80s. And from that point onwards, I've been the kind of person who would be very careful about my consumption. For example, I didn't learn to drive. I refused to learn to drive until I was 30 years old, when I was forced to because the kids came along and suddenly public transport was no good for three toddlers, you know. It should be, but it wasn't, which forced me to learn to drive. And up until that point, I'd just gotten everywhere by train and bike and so on, and tried to avoid flying and tried to see the world just, you know, these kind of like means which didn't pollute too heavily. However, I didn't actually get any kind of like official qualifications or anything in it until maybe 5 years ago or so, where I did Professor Michael Mann, I did his kind of 8-week course, which is just all, you know, a real kind of like grounding in the science and global impact of climate change. And that was fantastic. It was just what I needed to kind of like galvanize myself. And of course, around that time, you know, I believe Greta appeared as well. So that again really revived my interest in kind of like the environment and, you know, animals and the science of climate change. And then after that, I did Professor John Cook's course, all about the communication around climate change, and in particular the disinformation about climate change, and how the same tactics that were deployed to block any progress on stopping tobacco, you know, they cast doubt on all of the science and all of the findings and so on, which then extended the time before we finally started banning things like tobacco advertising and so on. Those very same techniques were then used by the fossil fuel industry to carry on burning their product. They just cast out on the science, even though we've known for what, 40 years more?
Longer than that,
about the harmful effects of CO2 and other warming gases in the atmosphere and the planet. And that was absolutely fantastic, because it meant I was able to enter the kind of like social media arena and immediately start questioning some of the things that were flung at me as we were discussing the climate on things like Twitter and Facebook and so on. And then after that, I did a year-long course with the UC San Diego, which was all about bending the curve, and that was all about the solutions and how we start, you know, moving that needle back down, how we get the CO2 to halt and start going back down to net zero, whatever you want to call it, where we kind of like balance out. Although I prefer the term climate positive, where we actually go further than net zero and we actually start really extracting the CO2 from the atmosphere to a point.
Yeah, carbon negative or climate positive, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so then armed with that, oh, and the other thing I did a very, I helped John, Dr. Cook out with a thing, I can't remember the name of the university he was with at the time. He's with the University of Melbourne.
Melbourne now.
Yeah, but at the time he was in a different university. Anyway, the point was, me and a bunch of his kind of like undergrads and so on were given the task of looking through a whole bunch of abstracts about anything, paleoclimatology, you know, the movement of rivers, and seeing if they linked to climate change in any way. And the way I helped was just reading the abstracts and going, yes, this is linked, that isn't. And then he took all that information then and used it to reconfirm the percentage of climate scientists who agreed that, yes, it's man-made, it's anthropogenic, still have a massive problem, and we still agree, just as was discovered by Naomi Oreskes when she investigated it, and then again by John Cook years later, and now again in John's latest paper. So I was a bit involved in that as well. So at work, though, for reasons, for certain reasons, I can't tell you where I work, but I can tell you the industry I work in. I work in general insurance, and motor insurance is a big part of that. So I went to my boss and said, look, I've learned all this stuff. And I was a corporate trainer at the time. I've learned all this stuff. I really feel that our company should be making our staff aware of this. We already had a kind of like a team that worked with the kind of like facilities department and encouraged recycling, and they were working very, very hard in decarbonizing, such as getting all the renewable energy from renewable sources and installing their own solar panels and stuff. So they were already working really hard on that, but there wasn't really any kind of like staff engagement thing going on. And I wanted to kind of like go, hey guys, look at this. Let's make you aware of this. And just as a as an introduction, I did it amongst my immediate peer group, a whole bunch of trainers who trained out around to about, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 people in the company, and just did a 30-minute thing on, here's what I've learned about the science, here's what I've learned about the global impacts, here's what I've learned about the communication, now here's some things that you can do both individually and to tackle systemic change. And it was quite bizarre that some of them turned to each other and afterwards and were like, is this real? which gave me an understanding that it's just not, you know, people in bog standard kind of like jobs getting on with their lives, and that, you know, they're either aware and they don't feel that there's anything they can do about it, they're aware and they don't care, or they're not aware, they've got no clue that this is happening, you know.
Yeah.
That it's going down, it's just completely out of their worldview, you know. So from that point onwards, I used that as a springboard. I got in touch with someone in the who was a bit higher up in the echelons, who said, Dave, yeah, we actually need this right now, so let's do a 6-month kind of engagement plan in the company, which I called climate positive, because we want to bend that curve. We don't just want to halt it at net zero. Yep. We want to right back down to where it was, ideally about 290 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're never going to see that for several lifetimes, I don't think, if we were successful. Do you know what I mean? But we can dream, right?
Yeah.
We got to have that hope. We got to put things in place that hopefully the next generation will pick up the ball and carry on running with it. And so the 6-month engagement plan was hugely successful. I managed to get the company internet to put up a whole section, which included loads of articles written by me, sections on podcasts from Professor Catherine Hayhoe, for example, her great Global Weirding
Amazing.
Podcast. Yeah, they're fantastic. And, you know, loads of other videos from, you know, Antonio Guterres and what he's been saying at the UN and stuff like that. And also we managed to get, we had a buy a book scheme going anyway, and I managed to persuade the buy a book guys to allow the staff to buy books that have been recommended by scientists and activists and so on. So we had John Cook's Cranky Uncle book in there. We had
all the excellent.
A couple of by Professor Mann. Obviously, Professor Hayhoe's were in there. We had The Silent Spring, you know, from back in the 60s. Great books. In fact, I'm just wondering if I've got a couple here. Oh, no, the only one I've got to hand is John Cook's Cranky Uncle versus Climate Change. That's a great book. That's so accessible, that book. Anyway, and so that was about 2.5 years ago, and it's been continuing on since then, where we've now got a kind of a Microsoft software called Viva Engage installed that our staff can access, which is kind of like Facebook for companies, I guess. And I've got a group going on there, which continues the whole staff awareness kind of thing, where people are invited to post up articles and then we all discuss them and so on and so forth. And what it's led to is that was all kind of like side of desk stuff on top of my usual job, but what it's led to is now I'm 6-7 weeks into a new role, which is sustainability executive in the company, off the back of this, where I'm working with a team. Well, the overall team, I think, is about 9 people for ESG, and I'm in the E team, the environment team, with a boss immediately over me and a colleague. We're just now starting to look at our company's transition plan.
Amazing.
Start mapping that out and hopefully have something published, maybe in brief by kind of like July this year, but then by July next year, the full proper kind of transition plan.
That's amazing.
So I finally actually got a climate job, you know, which all my kind of like work and everything has kind of like just led me to this point, you know. So I'm just hoping I pull it off.
It sounds, you know what, it sounds positive as well. I mean, because these kind of things so often that get shoehorned into it, usually you get sustainability leads, which is usually like an extra responsibility for an existing member of staff. And when it comes to schools, you know, the government have got this mandated thing coming in now where all schools have got to have a designated sustainability lead in the school. And no doubt it'll either be given to a teaching assistant or a geography teacher and swept under the carpet mostly. But I hope that's not the case. My new job coming up, folks, which I might tell a bit more about a bit soon, but my new job is supposed to be coordinating these folks in the east of England. So,
oh, brilliant.
Yeah. But what I will mention on that is that it's something called Climate Ambassadors, which is involved with that. And I think, Dave, you and maybe some of your colleagues might want to consider, if not already, being a climate ambassador, because that sounds absolutely perfect. And you mentioned John Cook. We were lucky enough to actually get him on this podcast last year.
Fantastic. Yeah. Right, I'll pick that out.
Yeah, and what an interesting guy, really. I mean, he's another one. He didn't do environmental science or anything like that. He's a psychologist. And then he come through into, you know, his passion, and then all he's done is his cranky uncle stuff, all the papers and everything. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'll mention that book again, Cranky Uncle versus Climate Change. He's also a cartoonist.
Yes, because he did all the artwork for it, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so accessible. You can literally pick this book up anywhere and start reading, and you'll have fun with it. Because his cartoons are really funny. Yeah, I've got the app as well. So the app's great for kind of like really practicing to spot all the kind of like logical fallacies that you'll hear in an argument. But the book Cranky Uncle versus Climate Change also gives you a kind of like potted history of climate, who's involved, the big players, you know.
Brilliant.
And then starts then talking about, well, we've established, you know, it is happening and these are the reasons why. Now let's look at the people who are trying to dissuade you otherwise and the kind of arguments that they'll use and, you know. And it's great. It's really, really good. So many people in work have bought it off the buy a book scheme and stuff. And I just recommend it to anyone because even if you're not particularly interested in it, it's still quite a fun book to read just because of his zany cartoons and the way it's all laid out and stuff. Great. Yeah, I can't recommend it enough.
And I tell you what, folks, I mean, again, lots of you listening are teachers, not just geography teachers, but one of the things we try and get our kids to learn is things like critical thinking, being aware of bias, also us teachers ourselves being aware of bias. That is a fantastic book and a fantastic resource because it goes through all these different biases and these different things. So fantastic.
Hey, educators. If you teach any geography, environmental or human or physical science-based topics, then check out Kit Marie Rackley's website at geogramblings.com. There you will find musings, blogs, resources, analyses, and more. Perhaps you want to brush up, learn, or dig deeper into a geographical issue, or you're looking for a resource you can use in the classroom, or maybe looking for someone with an award-winning, diverse expertise and skill set to collaborate with you on a project. Kit Marie offers free 30-minute friendly consultations if you're looking to brainstorm ideas. Jog on to geogramblings.com to explore and find out more.
So while we're on the subject of cartoons, because John does his old cartoons and stuff like that, is you like comics, but before we go on to the complete, you're telling us about your love for comics. Of course, one thing you sent me after our chat with Andy was this fantastic thing, and I'm showing it's called Discourses of Climate Delay, and it's based on an academic paper from Lam et al. In 2020, and it's just a fantastic kind of like they've turned it onto almost a graphic novel of the different ways that these nefarious, or some, you know, maybe some unintentional, but mostly nefarious kind of motives can try to prevent climate action. So, so you sent me this one, Dave, and you talked about another one. So these comics then, so first of all, let's start with these climate change ones. I mean, the Cranky Uncle book, this one, and you told me about another one before we started recording called The Dawn of the ECT. One thing I've been delighting in the last year or two is how much more accessible climate change and climate literacy and the science has become, but not just the science itself, things like why there's delay, the politics behind it, and all that kind of stuff. So,
That hard copy you've got there, that's available as a free ebook. So well as the other one, the Dawn of the ECT that Celine Keller's drawn and released as well. So maybe they're worth putting in the show notes as well, the links to those.
Yeah,
links.
Certainly will, folks. Yeah. I've got the physical copy here, but they are downloadable as free PDFs. And it's just, so for example, there's a page here with regards to, there's a quote here from Bill Gates talking about, climate and whatnot, but then it's got an asterisk and says, but Gates is one of the world's biggest super emitters due to his regular private jet. And this comes under the category of technological optimism, so Bill Gates is one of these people who feels that we will, things can be solved through innovation and technology, which is
wishful thinking, I guess.
Yeah. Just put a giant mirror up into, he doesn't say this, but a giant mirror up in space and
the atmosphere with sulfur again. Yeah.
Oh God.
I know.
So actually, I tell you what, this is interesting, but I did one of these workshops with some year four students. So year four folks is like 8, 9 year olds, right? And one of them actually said something quite clever, but obviously it's a misconception. But coming from a kid, it was actually quite clever if you think about it. And they said, I've learned that, that volcanoes actually make things colder, like, and I was like, okay, interesting. Where'd you hear that from? Yeah, no, I saw it on a TV documentary or something like that. It says, why don't we just set off all the volcanoes? And I was like, and actually, coming from an 8 year old, which their mind isn't like tainted by vested interests and stuff like that. I was like, actually, that's not too bad of an idea. And of course I was trying to explain to him, says, yeah, it kind of doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
I said, yeah. So can you think of the other problems that might come with like trying to set off all the world's volcanoes,
Great.
But yeah, so it's stuff like that. I'm not a fan of geoengineering, but sticking on the topic of comics and spill the beans for us here, Dave, because you are a big, big fan of 2000 AD in particular.
Huge fan. Yeah, absolutely. 2000 AD, the British anthology comic, most famous probably for Judge Dredd. Judge Dredd turned up in issue 2 of 2000 AD, and he's basically never missed a prog since. Oh, they call him progs, by the way, not issues. Prog, short for program. So it should be prog, I suppose.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, goodness knows what prog they're on now. It's in the thousands. And I probably jumped on kind of like maybe the 300 or 400s. And as a 13-year-old doing a paper round, I read Judge Dredd, which always had a strip in the Daily Star as well, drawn by Ron Smith and written by John Wagner. And I'm looking at a wall of comic art in front of me. So I'm in my office at the minute, and I've got loads of kind of like comic art in front of me. And down in my living room, I've got even more comic art up on the walls.
Oh.
So in front of me, I've got, just to pick two examples, I've got an original page from Strontium Dog, which is probably the other stronger characters that are in the comic. Strontium Dog, Rogue Trooper, and Judge Dredd are probably like the most well-known characters from 2000 AD. And Carlos Esguerra, is the artist who was responsible for the creation of Judge Dredd. So, and Strontium Dog was one of my favorite strips in the comic. Him and Strontium Dog and Judge Dredd vied for my attention, really. Carlos sadly passed away a few years ago, and I'm just really happy and proud that I've managed to get just one page of his amazing art, on my wall. Next to that is a piece of art by John Higgins, who has done lots of kind of like artwork for Dredd, but also he's quite famous as a colorist. So you might know that he was the colorist for Watchmen and the Batman story, The Killing Joke, which is very famous, Brian Bolland drawn, written by Alan Moore, that Batman one, The Killing Joke. And of course, Watchmen is Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. Dave Gibbons and Alan Moore both cut their teeth in 2000 AD as well. Alan Moore wrote the famous Halo Jones, which is the story of disenfranchised teenagers stuck in a loop, this kind of like floating kind of place where they just dump people that have got no hope in life, basically the Dreg Society. And it's all about her escape into space, basically. And it's one of the most popular series to have ever come out of 2000 AD. That was written by Alan Moore. And Dave Gibbons used to draw things like Rogue Trooper. He's done a bit of Judge Dredd. So when Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons came together to do Watchmen, and John Higgins as well, were forced to be reckoned with. As we know, Watchmen is, it's practically in my comic Bible as the Watchmen, you know. But the John Higgins artwork I've got here is a great shot of Judge Death, who's Judge Dredd's nemesis, who comes from a world where the crime is committed by the living, therefore being alive is the crime. So the crime is life, the sentence is death. Yeah, that's his catchphrase. And I mean, Judge Dredd himself is not a hero by any means. He's the tool of a fascist paramilitary police state in the future. You know, Mega City One, the sprawling metropolis that takes up the entire eastern seaboard of the US after an atomic war. He's basically one of the policemen in a brutal police state. And the world that he inhabits is full of kind of like crazy people anyway, who have to deal with no employment. There's like something like 3% employment because the robots do most of the work, and the crime is rampant, and you know, people are just bored out of their skulls, not knowing what to do themselves. There's a great story where we're introduced to the character Marlon Shakespeare, who's called Chopper. He goes, he's King Scrawl. He goes out and he scrawls graffiti in kind of like strange places. But just as an example of how bored the citizens are, his mum and dad, the things they do to keep themselves amused is his mum perpetually washes dishes. She washes them, she dirties them again, and then she washes them again. And she says to her son, "You've got to have a hobby. You've got to keep yourself busy." And his dad is practicing butting eggs into a bucket. You know, he's got a machine that throws eggs at him, and he tries to butt them into buckets and never succeeds. "One day, son, I'll get it, and that day everyone will know my name." Kind of thing. Bert Shakespeare is dad. So that gives you an idea of the kind of the life that the citizens of Mega City One are leading. So obviously mischief and crime and so on ensues, and so we've got these enforcers, the judges, for whom, you know, I think the mantra is judge, jury, and executioner. They've got the power to suspend instant justice. So put people in the cubes for an inordinate amount of time for things like littering or jaywalking or whatever. And through this kind of like foundation, we have these amazing stories. They could be humorous. They could be satirical. There was a lot of satire. John Wagner wrote I think the whole concept of Judge Dredd was to compare it to Thatcher's kind of police state of the 80s and the way it was going.
Interesting.
So 2000 AD is a huge favorite of mine. I've got two original pages of Judge Dredd downstairs as well, and just, you know, some other pages from some other artists from 2000 AD as well. Have I got any from other comics? No, I think it is all my original stuff is 2000 AD, thinking about it. So yeah, I do have a couple of other pieces of art. I've got one print all the way from the US, which is a fantastic portrait of Carrie Fisher as the Messiah holding a dog and giving her one finger salute. You know? And that looks down at me every day as I work, and just, you know, keeps me in my place.
Yeah. So. Well, also quite motivating as well, I take it, because she always had that that character, that persona, didn't she, where she was like, screw it, I'm doing what I want to do, kind of. She's absolutely a strong feminist, and so yeah, too right. I wonder if you've been asked this question before. Why was it 2000 AD that caught your attention and caught your spark more than, I'm not saying you don't enjoy other comics like Marvel or DC or anything like that, but why was it 2000 AD? Why have you not got Marvel plastered up there, or DC plot, or any other comic franchise up there?
Yeah, interestingly, whenever I have branched out into DC or Marvel or whatever, it's because the comic strip that I'm enjoying from them is written or drawn by people that originally started with 2000 AD. Everything comes back to 2000 AD. And I read The Eagle and before 2000 AD, and I read Scream I mean, these were like going back kind of like early 80s kind of comics and stuff. And I read quite a lot of the old war comics as well, Battle, Action, Victor, all that kind of stuff, you know. Lots of Germans running around going, Schnell, Schnell, as the hero plows through them in a stolen German, you know, vehicle or some kind or another.
Very cliche.
They were terrible. Yeah, they were terrible. And I loved 2000 AD because 2000 AD often subverted all the stuff that I'd read previously. So, for example, there was a cracking strip called Bad Company, and it was all about an army unit on an alien planet fighting the Kree. And it was kind of like gung-ho, like those old kind of like Battle and Victor and Action and so on. But you just see them becoming more and more degraded and becoming shadows and shells of their original beings as they go through this war. And that really kind of like affected me, because I think there was only one other comic strip that kind of portrayed war in that way prior to that, and that was Charlie's War, written by Pat Mills, who was actually the founder of 2000 AD. And Charlie's War was all about World War One and the trenches, and that was the first time that anyone tried to depict in comics what it actually was really like for people in the trenches. But that I think that wasn't in 2000 AD, but it was written by Pat Mills, who then went on to found 2000 AD. So 2000 AD often had these kind of very kind of like anarchic elements, or these elements where they tried to portray the real world, but through the lens of science fiction, right? So you had Thatcher, you know, who relied more and more on police. So John Wagner said, right, well, let's take this to its logical conclusion, where we end up with a police state. What does that look like? How do the citizens react to it? So that was that. And then we also had, in Strontium Dog, we had a two... tier kind of like society. It was set after an atomic war in the UK. There were the Norms, the people who managed to get through the war okay, and then there was the Muties, the humans who, because of radiation, strontium 90 in particular, hence the name Strontium Dog, suffered these mutations, and then were, as they, you know, grew into adults and had kids of their own, they created a group of which were second class citizens. And that story in particular, Portrait of a Mutant, which I actually discussed with Eamon on the Mega City Book Club, if you ever want to check that out, that two-tier kind of like society really reflected not just what we'd seen in, for example, in Nazi Germany, but also what we'd seen around the world, kind of like roughly at the same time, such as the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and places like that. And because it was put into a comic strip, into a science fiction comic strip, they got away with showing a hell of a lot of the awful things that happen under such a prejudiced and oppressive kind of like regime. So these poor Muties, they were, you know, they were kind of like lined up and shot for the minor infractions. There are some of them were herded into concentration camps. They were refused food, they were refused medical aid, they were, you know, dumped in slums. They weren't allowed to have the jobs that Norms, you know, the unmutated people, could have, and all this kind of thing. And that was really, really reflective of kind of like fascist regimes around the world, where genocide starts to happen. You know, and then in the comic, thankfully, Johnny Alpha joins a crew of mutants who are rebelling, who are basically saying, no, enough's enough. And they start raiding depots and arming themselves and fighting back, kind of thing. And actually becomes very violent. There's a lot of violence in 2000 AD, but again, couched in comic strip. So, you know, you could get away with it. Mm. So it's the satirical element, it's the humanist element, it's the anarchic element. And those things I've often found are missing from Marvel. They're just not there, you know, or they're there just in a very, very basic way, kind of thing. And these themes and these kind of these ways of telling stories didn't really enter Marvel and DC until they started poaching the writers from 2000 AD. And they did, and the artists, and they poached them in droves because they could pay them more.
Right.
And so, you know, so people would come to 2000 AD, like Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons, you know, Grant Morrison, Brian Bolland, oh, crumbs, the list goes on and on and on. They'd cut their teeth there, they'd do all some great work for 2000 AD, but then Marvel would swoop in and go, yeah, we can pay you double that, come and work for us, you know. Sweet. Hence, but, you know, if they hadn't done that, if DC hadn't done that, for example, we wouldn't have ended up with Watchmen, which is just like one of the best comics ever written. You know,
yeah.
It's the comic Bible. It's up there alongside Mouse by Art Spiegelman and Barefoot Jen. Mouse is all about the horrors of the Holocaust. And then Barefoot Jen is all about the horrors of Hiroshima, you know. Right. And in terms of kind of like storytelling and what it's trying to portray, I just think it's just a godlike level of comic creation. But that's just my opinion.
Wow. Well, and you know, it's like we were talking about earlier with when it comes to things like communicating climate science and stuff like that. You know, it is a medium to investigate, you know, things that we've been going on. Well, physical process, human processes, you know, and you're talking about, you know, the things happening in the world right now where a lot of that stuff can either seem very prophetic or can maybe provide a good analogy for what's happening in the world today. So it's...
Well, absolutely. I mean, I would certainly say with Judge Dredd, we are seeing the police around the world being armed and covered in body armor and given guns and, you know, batons and all kinds of things to suppress people, particularly around climate protesting. During the heat wave in Europe, as either last year or the year before, while the environmental protesters were out in the streets, the police were tear gassing them and when wading them with batons and stuff in France, you know. So we're a lot of the things that John Wagner wrote about in the 80s and Judge Dredd, for example, we are seeing coming to pass with all these, as we descend more and more into these kind of like populist governments and where, you know, people who are trying to fight for the planet are seen as the enemy as opposed to,
yes, yeah,
you know, they're, and the police are then tools of the state to suppress them so that the powers that be can carry on buying, selling fossil fuels, burning
you know, if some people listening think this is might be hyperbole, we'll put it this way, folks, it's like some of the work that I'm doing at the moment, whether it is like climate activism or whether it is things like decolonizing the curriculum, there are some members in the current government who've described folks like me as educational extremists. So, you know, that's the language. And so it's not Dave and I here, you know, being, you know, hysterical. It's the, you know, the language is being used by the people in power to describe folks what we do, you know, that, you know, and the pushback, you know, the freedom of speech kind of thing with, you know, on higher educations, which is basically clamping down on universities being able to say no to hate speech, basically, you know, and things like that. So this is why, you know, people like us and like me get accused of being woke, which is bizarre, which is a bizarre insult, really, isn't it? It's so bizarre. It's like what woke is like, No, like, wouldn't you rather be aware of what's going on around you and not sleepwalking into a Judge Dredd situation, you know, which is what these comics exist to do. It says, look what the 1984 and George Orwell, all these kind of things, which, and quite a lot of stuff we talked about in that climate change podcast, you know, with the Great Derelict, it's all there. I'm going to move on, Dave, before we do go down that particular rabbit hole. And we'll, let's bring it into the light a little bit more. Before we end our chat, there's just two things I really want you to quickly talk about, because you're not going to get away with it. Is you also are interested in stereophotography, and there is a bleeding heart behind you in the shot. God, give us a little bit of a. Give us a bit of a rundown of those two hobbies of yours. I mean, that's just incredible. What a man of many talents.
Okay, let's try and keep this quick then, because I realize we're running out of time, and because the two of them do have some stories behind them. I'll start with the harp. Back when I was 17 years old and I moved into my first ever digs, my first kind of like bedsit kind of thing, my landlord was aware that I was always acutely short of money, and so he said, oh, hey, see that big mansion across the road there? He'd actually taught me some landscape gardening, and he said the woman that lives in that mansion with their daughter over there needs some work done in the garden, hedges taken down and so on and so forth. So I worked for a whole summer and in that garden. It turned out that woman was the lead harpist for the Welsh National Orchestra at the time. So as a 17-year-old, she would literally have the harp there in her what's that bit of the house that kind of like sticks out or whatever, and with the windows open and play, and I would just listen to her play as I kind of took care of a garden and whatnot. And every now and again she'd make me a cup of tea, and she'd bring me inside, and I'd ask her questions about the harp, and she'd show me the music that she was looking through, and I'd be like, oh my god, how can you even read that? It just looked like lots of black dots and things everywhere. I was like, ah. And she was like, oh, I read this like I read a book. And I was just amazed. And I just kind of like fell in love with the instrument. And I swore at that time that at some point in the future, whenever I could afford it, and whenever I had the time, I would also learn to play the harp. because I was just so enamored by it. But then, you know, life happened and I went to university and, you know, got a job and, you know, all these kind of like dreams as a youngster kind of like fell away from me and I forgot about them kind of thing. And then about 15, 16 years ago, this album came out by this person called Joanna Newsom, who is a kind of like contemporary folk harpist called Ys, spelled Y-S. And I just read a review of it and I kind of thought, oh, harp. Yeah, I used to like the harp. Why was that? And I bought the album and the album's just amazing. It's a crazy kind of like, she has this kind of like raucous way of singing, or she did at the time, which was in stark contrast to her amazingly beautiful harp playing, but it brought back all the memories. And it just happened that the company I was working for at the time had floated and I was flush. I did actually have a bit of money I could throw at it. And I was like, right, I'm going to grab myself like a little folk harp. It cost about $2,000 or so, and wow, try and teach myself. And I just couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong. As it turns out, I was playing the treble clef of both my right hand and my left hand, when really speaking, it's the treble clef of the right hand and it's the bass clef of the left hand. After 2 weeks, I gave up and thought, right, I'm going to get professional tuition, and just reached out to the first person that I could see in an advert, which turned out to be Glenda Cluid. Glenda Cluid's been my tutor for the last 15, 16 years. My first ever lesson with her was just amazing, completely blew my mind. And within 2 weeks, I'd swapped the folk harp for the grand concert harp that you can see behind me.
I can see, yeah.
A Venus Penty 47 wow, string, kind of like 5-octave, 6-octave harp. Grand concert with the levers and everything.
Wait, and, did you just say 5 or 6 octaves?
Yeah, 47 strings. So what's that divided by 8? That's how many octaves there is.
No, you know. Yes. Wow.
Yeah. Then as the kind of like weeks, months progressed and I kind of like did a bit of digging on who Glenda was, it turned out that I had landed with one of the best harpists in all of Wales as my tutor.
Sweet.
I was like, sweet. Oh my God. But then to kind of like bring it full circle, while I was kind of like in the early days learning kind of like really basic stuff, I ordered a book of nursery rhymes for the harp just to kind of like entertain my kids and try and kind of, you know, find a reason for doing it, because it actually annoyed me. Anyway, and it arrived in the post and I pulled it out, and on the back cover was the woman whose garden I did.
No.
I was 17 years old. It was her that had written that book. So I'd come full circle, you know? And anyway, I've been doing the harp now for like 15 years. I'm doing my grade 6 performance exam at the minute.
That's amazing.
We've had two goes at it already. I'm only at pass level. My tutor wants me to get a merit, so we're going to do a third go at it. And I'm doing 4 pieces. And I've been learning these 4 pieces are beasts for grade 6. It's such a jump in from grade 5 to grade 6. It's such a jump in the standard.
Anyway, I always thought they were exponential, because when I was learning to play the saxophone, they seemed exponential each grade, to be honest.
Yeah. Although my tutor's, Glenda's, is basically saying that once I've done grade 6, that will have given me so many kind of like foundations that I'll find the next levels not quite so taxing, but really, really interesting musically. So I'm really looking forward to that. So that's the harp. Now, let's talk about the stereo photography.
This is just amazing, yeah.
So I've always loved 3D stuff, yeah? Always loved 3D films. Ever since I saw Jaws 3 in 3D in the cinema back as a kid. The film was terrible, but the 3D in it was fantastic, and I was sold on 3D as a result. And then I had 3D comics. Every now and again, the Eagle would do like a 3D special with the red and green glasses, and you'd see your comic characters leap out of the page at you and stuff. Oh, great, you know. But what I didn't realize was that since 1850, pretty much since the dawn of photography, there's also been stereo photography, where you took two images, one designed for the left eye and one designed for the right eye. And if you look at it through a particular viewer, or if you use a particular viewing technique, the image pops into 3D. How I became aware of that was a friend of mine, Wayne, who's a fellow Queen fan, he said to me, Dave, you're into your 3D TVs and your 3D films and stuff. Did you know that there's a Queen in 3D book? And I was like, what? And sure enough, there's a book called Queen in 3D. It's actually done by Brian May. So the story behind that is that Brian May is a huge stereo photography advocate. He's been a stereo photographer since he's a wee lad. And throughout his entire career with Queen, and even his life, he took stereo photos of on tour, and Freddie on stage, and the guys relaxing in the dressing gown on planes and stuff. And the book is both autobiographical, and it's completely in Brian's words, and all the photos are by Brian. You know, and I was amazed. So I bought that book, and in it, Brian teaches you how to do the basic ones, basic pictures, just with like a phone where you take two pictures quickly side by side like that, or you get a camera like one of the ones I've now got. Like I've got a Fuji Finepix 3DW3, which is 10-year-old bit of kit, but it's really compact 3D camera, which I'd take with me and you know, take pictures of concerts and stuff and think. Anyway, leaping ahead a bit. But I went on his website because he revived, Brian May revived a London stereoscopic company, which exists now, and has a whole bunch of kind of like books on stereoscopy, the history of it, these French things called diablés, which were old turn of the century 3D depictions of hell and skeletons in a satirical way that reflected the politics of the time. Absolutely amazing. Diablés, get that book if you can. Superb. But also, of course, he's an astronomer, isn't he? So we've got Mission Moon in 3D, stereoscopic pictures from the moon. We've got his conversions of space pics in 3D, all sorts. He's just done Bennu the Asteroid. A big 3D book on that, which is just incredible. You can see orbital paths and 3D and stuff in the book. It's mad. So anyway, one of the things that they were doing during, I picked this up kind of like during COVID, and one of the things that they said on the website was to send your pictures in, send your stereo photographs in. So as a beginner, I just started spamming them with my work. Until eventually, like when we started coming out of kind of, I mean, technically we're still in COVID, aren't we? But when we started coming out of lockdowns and stuff, they said, right, thanks for all your contributions from around the world, folks. We're actually going to compile this into a book. So Brian May edited this book of stereo photographs from kind of like amateurs like myself from around the world, and turned it into a book called Stereoscopy is Good For You. It's at the bottom of a pile here. Hang on, let me just pull it out. There it is, Stereoscopy is Good For You, A Life in 3D, edited by Brian May. And one of my pictures ended up in it. On page 72. I mean, this is useless for the listeners at home. They're not going to see any of it. But on page 72, yeah, there's the picture of me and my dog Punky in glorious 3D running across a bridge on the Welsh coastal path. You know,
amazing.
Yeah. So, and it meant that when the book launched in London, and one of the galleries in London, Proud Galleries in London, I got the chance to go down and meet Brian, and you know, be there for the kind of like the second day of the launch, and meet all my fellow kind of like enthusiasts who'd also submitted their work and stuff, and made a few friends who are still friends now, and things like that. And then, you know, a later date, actually, not long after, maybe a couple of months after, I got the chance to meet Brian again at an actual stereoscopy event at the Proud Galleries, separate from the book. But it was fun, actually, because I'd actually gotten married the week prior. I'd gotten married, and then I had one day where we weren't doing anything, and then we were off on a honeymoon. And it just so happens, just by pure chance, that was the one day where Brian May sent me an invite going, come on down to Proud Galleries for this kind of like second day of the book launch event, and we'll say hello and we'll talk about stereoscopy and blah, 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 blah. And so, yeah, so we came back from our wedding, which is up in Monmouth, and then the very next morning I belted down to London, had this mad kind of evening with Brian May and all these other enthusiasts, drunk all the champagne, and, you know, checked out everyone's work on the walls in this gallery and stuff, where we were exhibited in the gallery in London for about 3 months. It was amazing. And then immediately after that, piled straight back home, and then jumped in the car and drove up to Loch Lomond for our honeymoon. Just a completely insane period of my life, you know. But anyway, since then I've continued with it, and I've produced a few kind of like books for myself of my work, just so that they're not, don't end up lingering on a hard drive. I've actually got them printed out on highlight kind of like books, where you can kind of like view them with viewers and stuff, so I'll always have a permanent record of it. And also, because I've gotten into the band Henge, they were kind enough, as well as me turning up at the gigs and taking 3D pictures, they were kind enough for me to kind of like go behind the scenes and do a 3D photo shoot of them in all of their outfits and stuff, which I was then able to kind of like transpose them over kind of like 3D landscapes of the moon and alien planets.
Amazing.
And so I've bundled those down to them as well. And in actual fact, I mean, they don't know this yet, but I've just done another 3D publication for them.
Exclusive, folks.
Yeah, yeah. But don't tell them. They're going to be surprised.
Oh,
We'll keep it between you and me, so I'm all good.
Yeah, I'll show it to you another time. But it's called the Hens 3D Extravaganza, which is a compilation of some of the 3D pictures that I've taken of them, but done in the old red and blue glasses style. But also they've got some comics out, so I've depth mapped their comics, and so the first three pages is their comic with a little thing at the bottom saying, "Hey, if you want to read more, go and buy the actual comic," you know. But amazing. Here's the 3D version plus then pictures of them, you know. Anyway, yeah, so that's my stereo 3D stuff.
Wow.
I could bang on about it all night. I'll stop.
Well, no, folks, that's I'm blown away in the, but you know, like, ah. Oh. Whew, that was lovely. Oh, thanks, Dave. No, what stories? And I know there are so many people listening thinking, we need more of this, we need more. But unfortunately, we're approaching almost the hour mark. We're getting into Andy Pallastri's territory now. So. Oh, oh, no, I've been enjoying this so much. So let's finish off then Dave, with We All Geographers. I know you've had a thought about this. You teased it a bit earlier.
Yeah.
So here we go. But first, you've got to have a go at the folks who was on last time. So last time we had my first ever, and it's taken me almost 100 episodes to get to it, but like partners, couples, you know, episode where, you know, and on this occasion it was a husband and wife, and it was everything I thought it would be, you know, the little bit of bickering and bantering, and it was just perfect. So Sam and Simon, you were marvelous. And I think it was Simon came up with something quite cool for a word and was like, yeah, we just need to do this. And Sam was like, no, we're going to do this. So he has deferred to her, and you're going to be doing the word bubbles for 30 seconds, Dave.
Bubbles.
You like about bubbles for 30 seconds.
Oh, right. So it is the aim to try and guess what they were thinking about in terms of bubbles?
No, just you riff for 30 seconds. I'd say, what I usually say is, you say, if you can link it to something geographical. So it could be like climate change. So great. Yeah. That's like bonus. Yeah. If not, just riff about bubbles. So when you're ready, mate, I'll start the 30 seconds.
Okay, let's go.
Go for it.
Okay, so Peroni, what I'm drinking, there's bubbles in there. The bubbles are carbon dioxide, don't they? And I was actually accosted in the pub one time. We went on an Extinction Rebellion march in Cardiff. And when we got back after the march and we had all our placards and that in the pub, and some student teachers were there, and she said, oh, hang on, what about the carbon dioxide in the beer that you're drinking? Is that not bad for the environment? And I was like, well, no, that's part of a natural cycle. The whole brewing process and stuff is part of a natural cycle. What we don't want... run out of time. Actually burn the stuff that's been buried under the ground for millions of years and hasn't interacted with our atmosphere for like millions of years. We just don't want any more of that coming up, you know. So yeah, so there we are, bubbles.
So where does that come in, the whole discourses of climate delay, that the excuse that, well, you're drinking beer.
Yeah, you're drinking beer, therefore you're part of the problem.
Is that false equivalency argument? Is that what it's called?
Oh, yeah, false equivalency. Yeah, that's right.
Something like that. Anyway.
Well, yeah, or the hypocrite thing, isn't it, where you accuse of being a climate hypocrite. Well, we're all climate hypocrites, but
Two weeks ago with the episode, you know, with me and Catherine Walker, we talked about flight shame, for example, because the fact that my family's half American. So, you know, I'm a hypocrite for having a half American family. So, and we talked about that. So, yes, we are, you know. So go on then, Dave. What were you lining up for the next guest? Tell us.
Well, I thought it was something that they'd have to try and figure out, but I'll just say the word dungeon.
Okay.
And the reason I'm saying the word dungeon is it is centered on something that we did mention right at the start of the show, whereby Edinburgh Castle is hewn into the plug of a volcano, right? The seven hills that surround Edinburgh Castle are all that's left of the slopes of this enormous volcano, which was basically eroded by a huge, sweeping glacial event, right? And so Arthur's Seat, for example, is like one edge of they call them the crags. It's one edge of the old volcano where the glacier just came away and went whoop and lopped the edge of it, you know. And the the reason I say dungeon is because my grandfather was based in Edinburgh Castle. My grandfather's a military guy. He was based in Edinburgh Castle for a period of time, and the military can give access to the families places in Edinburgh Castle that other punters wouldn't usually see. And I was taken down into the dungeons, hewn into the basalt of this, you know, plug of this volcano, and where it was surprisingly dry, but absolutely freezing. And at one point we sat in the cell, and my grandfather's like, right, okay, watch this. Flipped the light off.
Yes.
Black. Nothing. Could see nothing. Yeah. And I could almost feel, it became very oppressive. I could almost feel the weight of all this rock bearing down on me, kind of thing, you know. So it was and I was only about, I would have been about 5 or 6, 7 at the time.
Wow.
So it was a hugely kind of like formative experience for me. So that's the word to carry on into the next one, dungeon. They can talk about dungeons.
Awesome. Absolutely fantastic. Wow. Okay, Dave. So last two things for you. Any shout outs at all, and where can people find you on social media if they want to connect with you?
If you want to come and check out my general rants about climate, that's at Scowling Monkey on Twitter. Scowling frowny face monkey, we all know how that's spelt. If they want to see my stereo stuff, it's at Stereo Simeon, and that's also on Twitter, where you'll see all my kind of like 3D stuff with a free viewing technique, so you know you can see all these things pop into 3D and have a go yourself. Anything else that's worth flagging up? No, that's probably the two main things. My big interest is the climate stuff, so you'll see me talking about a lot of climate stuff on my Scowling Monkey account, and I'll be sharing a lot of stuff from scientists and meteorologists and so on. So I hope that my feed under Scowling Monkey is quite informative in terms of, you know, climate, geography, meteorology, that kind of stuff. So,
yep, fantastic. And folks, one of the whole reasons for this podcast is to see, you know, us geographers, we're not just, you know, geeks with you know, elbow patches on a tweed jacket. We actually, I've got these quirks, these weirdness and kookiness about us as well. You know, you've amazing stories about the harp, everything, Dave. This has been such a fantastic discussion, and we could be here all night, honestly, and I'd be as happy as pie.
Oh, if you'd let me, I would have rambled on forever. But yeah, it's been great. I've been amazed how quickly the time has gone. I've really enjoyed it.
It's ridiculous.
Thanks very much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had fun. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the podcast and give us a rave review. Make sure you share and rate each episode, as every time you do this, it helps more people find us and continues the conversation. If you fancy being a guest or have any feedback, follow us on Twitter at @coffeegeogpod and send us a DM. Or you can email us at coffeegeogpod@geogramlings.com. Until next time, keep jogging.